Hi everyone, welcome. I'm Janet B. For those of you who don't know me, I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. Super excited to talk about this chapter, There Is a Solution. Even the title, right? We could talk about for a while. There is a solution. A solution one. So this program doesn't offer 18 different ways. Now, they do say that if you find your own way, something else. We have no monopoly on God. We merely have an approach that works. But if we've decided that we want to do this program, these 12 steps, there's a solution. And what's that solution, right? Isn't that our question? First, what's the problem? What's the problem we're trying to solve for? And it tells us on page 45, lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? And then in this chapter, on page 25, it tells us what the solution is, how we find this power. Top of page 25, it says, but for the grace of God. And I looked up the word grace, and it says unmerited favor. So my problem it was, I didn't have the power to stop binging. Just like if I had cancer, I would have no power on my own to make my cancer cells stop multiplying. I would need some kind of outside intervention. And what we need here, what I needed here, was unmerited favor. Now, we've talked about this before. Sometimes people will say, no, I'm not going to get better. God's not going to help me because I'm not worthy. But unmerited favor means we don't get it because we're worthy. We get it because he loves us. Okay, so that's just the title. So let's dive in. First paragraph says that we knew thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill, and nearly all have recovered. It's interesting that they say the people who recovered are the people who were hopeless. Why? Because if I, you know, think about it, let's go back to a cancer example. No one who's got a headache is going to take chemo. The only people, I would say 100% of the people who take chemotherapy are people who are told they have cancer and that they really don't have any other options. They feel hopeless without that kind of medical intervention. And if we don't feel hopeless, what happens is when things get hard, we get going and we don't stick around. So it's really important that we feel hopeless and understand what this hopelessness is. And we're gonna talk about it. And they go ahead in the next paragraph. They say, yeah, we're people from every walk of life. Like people, I guess, like on the Titanic in shipwreck and then feel bound to each other. Wow, we all survived the Titanic. We got rescued from a sinking ship. And they say, okay, yeah, we had a common peril, but that's not what binds us. What binds us is we have a common solution. Unmerited favor, the grace of God has come in and rewired our hearts in such a way that the obsession with food or alcohol or drugs or whatever cannot live there anymore. The soil of our soul gets changed. This program is nothing less than that. So flipping the page to page 18, it says, an illness of this sort, and we believe it's an illness, and I'll talk more about that in a couple pages, involves people about us in a way human sickness doesn't. And it talks about the fruit of this illness, misunderstanding, fierce resentment, right? Normal people get resentful and, you know, they like eat half a pint of ice cream, and then the next day they forgive the person, and then they never have to eat the other half of the pint of ice cream. We get fierce resentments, and we go eat that pint and all the pints that are in the convenience store. Financial insecurity, how can we hold jobs when all we think about is food and how the world has wronged us? Disgusted friends and employers. And that's sad. And then the saddest part, warped lives of blameless children. So, but this illness is primary. These are just symptoms that we have this illness. But we can't just treat the symptoms. We can't just say, I'm going to be a better mom, a better wife, a better employee. We have to get it out by the roots, right? We have to have a root transplant. Go from the garden of self transplanted into the garden of God. That's what this program teaches us how to do. And if we go down to where they're talking in italics, and they're talking about, you know, like psychiatrists generally don't succeed with us, but an ex-problem drinker properly armed with the facts about himself who has found this solution. So I have no right to go and talk about any other solution in a 12-step room except this one. And it says, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Wow, that tells me if I'm working with someone, I'd better be willing to invest the time, a few hours. It's not, you know, take two food plans and call me in the morning. It's work. And they say, until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. Why? Well, I think it's what Melissa said at the beginning. People really need or recover best in an atmosphere where there's two things: correct information and love. I mean, if I love you, but I give you wrong information and say, take penicillin and that'll cure your compulsive eating, it doesn't matter how much I love you, you won't get better. But if I give you good information, but I'm really mean and nasty, then what happens if things are going wrong in your life? Are you going to be comfortable coming to me? No. So correct information and love. And then the next paragraph lists 9 things that we should have when we're trying to help others. So I'll just read them really quickly because they're here, don't really require much explanation. They've had the same difficulty, right? We used to be compulsive eaters. 2, we obviously know what we're talking about because we've done it. We've had the experience. 3, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer. So it's not like, yeah, I think I sort of kind of know what you need to do. It's like, no, if you do this awesome program, you will recover. 4, no attitude of holier than thou. All I am is someone who just got on the train a stop or two ahead of the next person. That's it. Nothing except the sincere desire to be helpful. No fees to pay. I tell my sponsees, when you recover, you know, you don't go hang up an eating disorder shingle and make a bunch of money off of what you've learned, you know, through this big book teaching. No access to, and we don't ever take a penny. By the way, we're free here. Even if anyone offered money, we wouldn't take a dime. We do this because it's fun. No access to grind. So we don't sit there and say, Weight Watchers stinks. We have no access to grind with anyone. No people to please. People aren't here to people don't recover by pleasing their sponsor. A sponsor is just a way to help us get a relationship with God. No lectures to endure. You might argue that this is a lecture and you're enduring it, but Melissa was very careful to say that this is a workshop. So no lectures to endure. And it says, after such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again. Beautiful image, right? It's like we're, you know, we're paralyzed and can't get out of bed. And then not only can we get out of bed, we can go and help others. And that's what this program tells us. So page 19, they say, it's the 5th sentence down. We feel elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. So what they don't mean is that putting down the drink is the first thing we do, is the beginning. They can't mean that, because as we'll see on page 24, we don't have the power to do that. They mean it's not enough to just put down the food. But obviously, if we could just put down the food, none of us would be here. You know, we'd all be like watching Friends reruns or something. But it's not enough. There's more to do once we recover. And then it tells us, all of us spend much of our spare time doing this work. We recover and we spend much of our spare time helping others. Much is hard to define, but I would say that if we're watching as much TV or spending as much time in the pool as we otherwise would have, we're probably not doing much, enough of the much. Okay, and so flipping down or coasting down to the bottom of page 19, they tell us that, and here's a principle we have to start practicing. And this is something we can practice from the day we walk in, the day we decide to recover. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers or eaters depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. So a few things it tells me right here that, again, if we're newcomers, we can start practicing this right away. Tolerance of other people's shortcomings. Okay, so someone doesn't always show up on time. So someone's a little brusque. It's okay. God sure has a lot to put up with me, and so does my husband, and so do my kids, by the way. Thank God that they're tolerant of my shortcomings. And respect for other people's opinions and attitudes. That means some of us may be Republicans, some of us may be Democrats, some of us may think, I don't know, vaccine mandates are good, and some may think it's bad. We don't have to agree, but we respect each other's opinions. And why? It makes us useful. If I'm a Republican and you're a Democrat and I sit there and tell you how awful your politics are, and then in the next breath I say, now come on, let me tell you how to recover, you're not going to be that interested in talking to me. So being tolerant of other people makes us useful. And okay, let's go a step further. Why does that matter? Then they tell us our lives depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. How come? Doesn't my life depend on like getting the right food plan and, you know, all that kind of stuff? And they're saying, no, they're not even saying it depends upon my prayer life, my constant thought of others and how it may help meet their needs. Yes, a prayer life is important, critical. But I don't believe the big book uses these words that, you know, it our very lives depend on it the way it does here. Why? Well, remember in chapter 5, it tells us what the roots of this illness are. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the roots of the illness. I need a root transplant. Now, I'm not capable of giving myself a root transplant. Only God can do that for me. But once I'm transplanted out of the garden of self into the garden of God, I can still water. I can still water the plant with unselfish good deeds. So that's why, you know, God does the work, but this is me cooperating with God. Okay. Then they say, okay, if you're someone who wants to get better, you may be asking, what do I have to do? And they say, that's what this book is. This book is going to tell us what we need to do to get better. And then it goes down at the very bottom. I love this part. I think it's so cool. Bottom of page 20, it talks about the three different types of drinkers. It doesn't say alcoholics. It's three different types of drinkers. And let's see. Stephanie, do you have your book?
I do.
Can you read with me starting moderate through the end of page 21 once he starts to drink?
Yep. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink.
Thanks. So here we have three different types of drinkers. We have the moderate one. So this would be someone like my husband. He was, I don't know, a little bit overweight, 10, 15 pounds, no more than that. But he had the weight on him. And then he went to the doctor. And the doctor said, Fred, you have high blood pressure. You need to lose that 10 or 15 pounds. So he just said, okay. And he just lost the 10 or 15 pounds. And this was, I don't know, 15 years ago. He's kept the weight off. If he ever sees the number on the scale creeping up, he's like, oh, I put on like a few pounds. I'm just going to cut back. And he does, and he's fine. I don't understand it. When they say men are from Mars, I say that man who can like eat that way is from Mars. I don't get it. But then here's the trickier one, the hard drinker. And this is a little confusing because this explains why, in my opinion, there's some people who can go to meetings and not work the steps and seem to get better. There are people who do need support and the fellowship. And it says even they may even need medical attention. That doesn't make someone an alcoholic. That doesn't make someone a compulsive eater. Just because they need the structure and support. Structure and support alone won't help a real alcoholic or a real compulsive eater. So I'll give you an example of a hard eater. My friend Elle, her husband said, oh, I can't have even one glass of wine. If I have one glass of wine, I can't stop. And so he said, I'm never again going to have a glass of wine. And to my knowledge, he never has, because he knew what would happen if he started. Now, if we think of ourselves, right? You know, if someone said, you know what, once you have one cookie, one whatever, you're not going to be able to stop. Who of us said, oh, thanks for the information. Now I'm never going to have one cookie or one whatever again, and was able to stop? No, because we're not moderate and we're not hard. We are, you know, what they call real alcoholics, real compulsive eater. And they say, what's this person? This is the person who loses all control once they start. And why is that like that? Just on page 22, real quickly, they say opinions vary. They don't waste time trying to tell us why we became compulsive eaters. We usually want to know why so we can figure out who to blame, usually our parents. They don't waste any time on it. They say, okay, yeah, we're people who begin to lose all control once we take the first compulsive bite. And then on page 23, they say, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion, right? For Elle's husband, it's academic and pointless what happens to an alcoholic once they take the first drink and the craving sets in, because he never takes the first drink. So it's academic and pointless. So it says, therefore, the main problem isn't the physical allergy, right? Because it's like, as I'll talk about in detail later, I am allergic to cats. I have a terrible physical allergy, totally irrelevant because I don't go near cats. It's academic, how my lungs, you know, will start wheezing and my nose will start dripping, academic and pointless. So it says, therefore, because we keep doing this, for us, it's not academic. The main problem of the alcoholic or the compulsive eater centers in his mind rather than his body. Now, it centers in his mind, but it doesn't start in the mind, right? On page 64 of our book, it tells us once the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So the recovery starts in the soul. The illness, you know, they seem to say, starts in the soul. And then, as it was explained to me once, kind of goes and sets up command central in our brains and starts calling the shots when it comes to food. So the main problem centers in our mind rather than our body. And it says later on the page, there's the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they're down for the count. Why? Page 24, at the very beginning, it tells us our problem isn't lack of desire. It isn't lack of knowledge. It's lack of power. How many times was I told before I recovered, oh, you just, you know, don't want it badly enough. I don't think people said it to my face, but as all those first 40, 50 sponsors were dropping me, I'm sure they were thinking that she doesn't want it badly enough. But here's what our book says. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. So I wanted to stop more than anything. I couldn't stop. I didn't have the power. And they're telling me that's the way it is. But of course, who would ever say to someone with cancer, you must not have a powerful desire to recover from cancer, or you'd be able to make your cancer cells stop multiplying? That would just be mean. People said it to me or about me, not to be mean, but just out of not really knowing, but we're powerless. So I'm going to answer the chicken and the egg question. If we're powerless, so some people say, get a couple days of abstinence, then you can start working the steps. But then the logical question to that is, well, how can I get any abstinence if I'm powerless? Some people can, you know, have a little bit of willpower, can hang on for a few days till they get to step two, where the book tells us that's when we first start accessing power, like a pick line of grace just starts going into our souls. But what do we do then, until then? So when people say, well, get abstinent, you can't, it's like saying, you've got cancer, make 10% of your cancer cells stop multiplying, then we'll give you chemo. We can't. So what's the solution? And there is an answer to the chicken and the egg question. God has to come first. So practically, how does that work? So let's say I meet a newcomer and the person can't stop. I get them to a safe place, right? Maybe I take them to my house. Or if we're sitting, like, let's say at a convention, and this is my sponsor, a sponsor I had, she went through the first 8 steps in a weekend. We can sit with someone and in a couple of hours, get them to understand that they are powerless and what that means, and get them to take a second step, right? Step 2, came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now that might take some time, but sometimes we need to put in that time. So it's not get abstinent and then work on getting power. Sometimes it is, you know, a lot of us, I would say most people, as soon as we make a decision to go through with this program, we get the grace to hang on for a little bit. But I would say if you're working with someone who is really trying and doing everything you say and can't, get them through those steps quickly. I mean, I've never gotten someone through in a weekend like my sponsor had been, but I certainly can get someone through step two in a weekend, or if I had to, in a few hours. So if someone is really struggling and you're working with them, maybe get them through the second step quickly and then keep on going. So how come we get to a point where the most powerful desire to stop is of no avail? We don't know why us and not other people. And again, the big book doesn't spend a lot of time, but they talk about what it means to lose the power of choice. And that's that paragraph in italics on page 24. Steph, could you read that, please?
The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring work.
Okay, Steph, I'm going to mute because you're sounding fuzzy. Can you hear her? Steph, your connection's bad, so I'm just going to read it myself. Okay.
Memory of.
Okay. So I'm going to read it because the connection was bad. So the fact is, most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We're without defense against the first drink. And for those of you who are new and haven't heard this before, the way that I best understand it is about a bridge that's been broken. They talk about we have no defense, memory, humiliation, what's the correlation between everything? And what they're saying is this: normally my memory is my defense against doing something dangerous, right? So let's say I'm about to, Rebecca, my dear sponsee, invites me to her house in Texas. Going to Texas is on my bucket list. But she's got at least one cat and I'm tempted to go, but in my memory are all these data points of cat-induced asthma attacks. So when Rebecca says, "You want to come to my house?" Before I answer, I'm tempted to say yes, because I want to see her. My memory grabs these data points, generates a little thought to run across the bridge to say, "Danger, stop. Cats will give you an asthma attack. You can't go." My memory has kept me from danger. Or tonight, my daughter and I made this really cool chicken and artichoke dish for dinner. And then if I'm cleaning up after, my wonderful husband did a lot of the cleanup. But let's say I was cleaning up and was wiping down the counters, and then I get to the stove and I'm about to wipe it down. My memory will find all those data points that say, "Danger, hot stoves burn you." Grab the data points, generate a little thought to run across the bridge to say, "Stop, don't wipe down the stove, wait till later." Again, my memory has kept me from danger. But if we think about food, when I was in college, there was a certain brand of cookies that I used to binge on. They would come in a box of 20. I would tell myself, "I'm just going to have one or two." We all know how that story ended. That whole box of 20 was gone. So in my memory were all these data points of, you say you're going to eat one or two, but you end up eating 20. And so there I go, about to go to the store to buy a box of cookies and just have one or two. And my memory does its job, grabs the data points that say, "You say you're going to have one or two, but you're going to end up eating the whole box. generates a little thought to run across the bridge to say, danger, stop, don't. You won't be able to stop at one or two. You're going to gain weight. You're going to hate yourself. Don't do it. Except when it came to food, the bridge was broken and the thought couldn't get across. As it says, our memory failed to hold us in check, and I was without defense. The way that my memory of cat-induced asthma attacks protects me, the way my memory of, you know, burning my fingers on a hot stove protects me. When it came to food, I didn't have that kind of protection. And thank you. On the Recovery Jam website, there's like kind of a write-up of the broken bridge explanation. So if you want to just go and you can just go and print it out if it's helpful to you. So there we are. And it says, when someone who has this kind of thinking, when this kind of thinking takes hold, we've probably placed ourselves beyond human aid. Again, on the next page, it says there's no return through human aid. The group can't be our higher power, right? What if all of you go out and binge and you're my higher power? Or what if I'm just, you're all doing great, but you're all busy at the time when I really need to talk to someone where I need help? You know, I need power. And as much as you all love me, hopefully, you can't give me that power, right? So what's the solution? And there it is on the top of page 25. It talks about alcoholics place themselves beyond human aid and unless locked up, die, go permanently insane. But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop, but cannot. So now we know what the solution is, right? Unmerited favor, the grace of God. How do we access the grace of God? Well, there may be lots of different ways. And our program tells us, again, we have no monopoly on God, but here's our way. Self-searching, leveling of our pride, confession of shortcomings, which the process, so they're telling us this is a process. Isn't that so cool? Like there's a process to get a miracle. First you do step one, then you do step two. It's a process. And it says it's required for successful consummation. If I'm going to, you know, bake something, I can't leave out step five or step eight. It's not going to come out any good. And so what do? When we hear about this, it says, we pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. And then this gorgeous promise on page 25. We have found much of heaven and we have been rocketed. Again, notice the passive voice. I don't take myself. Another force, God as I understand God, rockets me where? Into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. And Bill Wilson describes this fourth dimension on page 8. He says it's happiness, peace, and usefulness that's more and more progressive. Just like this illness is progressive, look how good God is, right? He doesn't just end the illness. He gives us happiness, peace, and usefulness that's progressive. And then it tells us what we need. The great fact is just this and nothing less, right in the middle of page 25. Nothing less. We should settle for nothing less. We've had deep and effective spiritual experiences. Again, God coming in and rewiring my heart. And what does he change? My whole attitude toward life, toward my fellows, and towards God's universe changes it all. The central fact of our lives, it's no longer me, myself, and I, is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered our hearts and lives, or you could say and lives, either way works, in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us, which we could never do for ourselves. This isn't an impersonal force like the wind or some cosmic energy. Cosmic energy doesn't come in and change my attitudes toward life, towards fellows, towards God himself. This is this is God as we understand God. And then it tells us, if you're serious, there's no middle of the road solution. Either we go on blotting it out or we accept spiritual help. And page 26 tells about someone who went to one of the best psychiatrists ever, Carl Jung, and he just told him he was hopeless. And the guy asked him, is there anything that could ever help? And he said, you know, page 27, sometimes there's these phenomena of spiritual experiences. I looked up the word phenomenon today and it says something that is extraordinary, not like in the realm of normal. Huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces, are suddenly cast to one side and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate us. Like our whole insides are changed. And it says suddenly, and then later they put the appendix in, appendix two, to say that I think early on they were sudden. You know, God was getting this thing off the ground. You know, it was like, boom, Bill Wilson and company had quick spiritual experiences. There are times I read this and I would get scared and I'm like, oh, I'm not completely changed. I still have like nasty thoughts about this person, or I'm lazy, or, you know, I'm not, you know, 100% rearranged. But that appendix tells us that we have spiritual awakenings. And for some of us, me, slow learner, it's gradual, but we always have to be moving in that direction. We should always be able to look back and at how we were a year ago and say, am I doing better spiritually? Am I growing in understanding of God, of my usefulness to others more than I was a year ago? And hopefully we'll all be able to say yes. On page 28, it tells us we sought the same escape from this illness with all the desperation of drowning men. People who are drowning don't ask what color the lifeboat is. They're just happy to get in. And it says, what seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. How do you grab on to a flimsy reed? But first, here's some clues about God they give us. The loving and powerful hand of God. They're telling us God is loving and God is powerful. And how do we do it? Well, the next paragraph tells us, it says, okay, we're not going to tell you there's only one way faith can be acquired. But it says, all of us, no matter what our race, creed, or color, are children of a living God, a living creator, with whom we may form a relationship. So it tells me what I have to try to do, form a relationship with this God upon simple and understandable terms. And it says, when do we get it? As soon as we're willing and honest enough to try, willing to do the work, willing to start with a prayer that may say, God, I don't know if you exist, but if you do exist and you do care and are able to help me, I need some help. And then we start about being tolerant, being useful to others as best we can. We do what we know and we're honest. We don't put on our, you know, shiny, happy face to God and say, oh, I believe in you. Everything's fine. We say, God, you know, I've got some doubts about some things and we wrestle with them. That's okay. It's honest. Remember, God can't live where there's dishonesty. So it tells us, we form a relationship with God, not just a belief in him, a relationship. I mean, I can like believe that my husband exists, but if I don't talk to him and, you know, hang out with him and get to know him, I can't say I have a relationship with him. So page 29, it tells us clear cut directions are given showing how we recover. They're going to tell us exactly what to do. And then after that is the personal stories. And what do all those stories have in common? each person shows from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. So whenever we're telling our stories after we recover, that's really what we want to do. How do we establish a relationship with God? How do we do it? And then they tell us, they close by saying, our hope is that many alcoholic men and women, compulsive eater, men and women, desperately in need, that's our audience, those who are desperately in need, will see these pages. And we believe it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems, right? We show our warts to each other, that they will be able to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I must have this awesome relationship with God.